Section 1. You will hear a woman, Paula, phoning her friend Ralph about an application to the local council for money for their drama club. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 3. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 3.
Hello?
Ralph, it's Paula.
Hi.
You know I told you we could apply to the local council for money for our drama club? I've got the application form here, but we need to get it back to them by the end of the week. I could send it on to you. You really ought to fill it in as president of the club, but I don't know if it'll get to you in time.
Well, you're the secretary, so I expect it's okay if you fill it in.
Yeah, but I'd really like to check it together.
Right, that's fine.
Like, the first part asks for the main contact person. Can I put you there?
Sure.
Right, so that's Ralph Pearson. Oh, and then I need your contact address. So that's 203 South Road, isn't it?
No, 230.
Oh, sorry, I always get that wrong. Then it's Drayton. Oh, do you think they need a postcode?
Better put it, it's DR6 8AB.
Okay. Telephone number, that's 01453 586 098, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. Now, in the next part of the form, I have to give information about our group. So, name of group, that's easy. We're the Community Youth Theatre Group. But then I have to describe it. So, what sort of information do you think they want?
Well, they need to know we're amateurs, not professional actors. And how many members we've got. What's that at present? 20?
18. And should we put in the age range that's 13 to 22?
No, I don't think we need to. But we'd better put a bit about what we actually do. Something like members take part in drama activities.
Activities and workshops?
OK.
Right. That's all for that section, I think.
You now have some time to look at questions 4 to 10 on page 66. Now listen and answer questions 4 to 10.
Now, the next bit is about the project itself, what we're applying for funding for. So, first of all, they need to know how much money we want. The maximum's £500.
I think we agreed we'd ask for £250, didn't we?
OK. There's no point in asking for too much. We'll have less chance of getting it. Then we need to say what the project, the activity is.
Right. So we could write something like, to produce a short play for young children.
Should we say it's interactive?
Yes, good idea.
Right, I've got that. Then we have to say what we actually need the money for.
Isn't that it?
No, we have to give a breakdown of details, I think.
Well, there's the scenery.
But we're making that.
We need to buy the materials, though.
Oh, OK. Then there's the costumes.
Right. That's going to be at least £50.
OK. And what else? Oh, I just found out we have to have insurance. I don't think it'll cost much, but we need to get it organised.
Yes, I'd forgotten about that. And we could be breaking the law if we don't have it. Good thing we've already got curtains in the hall. At least we don't have to worry about that.
We'll need some money for publicity. Otherwise, no one will know what we're doing.
And then a bit of money for unexpected things that come up. Just put sundries at the end of the list.
Okay, fine. Now, the next thing they want to know is, if they give us the grant, how they'll be credited.
What do they mean, credited?
I think they mean how we'll let the public know that they funded us. They want people to know they've supported us. It looks good for them.
Well, we could say we'd announce it at the end of the play. We could make a speech or something.
They might prefer to see something in writing. We'll be giving the audience a programme, won't we? So we could put an acknowledgement in that?
Yeah, that's a better idea.
OK, and the last thing they want to know is if we've approached any other organisations for funding and what the outcome was.
Well, only National Youth Services. And they said that at present funds were not available for arts projects.
Right, I'll put that. And then I think that's it. I'll get that in the post straight away. I really hope we get the money.
I think we've got a pretty good chance. Hope so anyway. Thanks for doing all this, Paula.
That's okay. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
That is the end of section one. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 2 on page 67. Section 2. You will hear Joanne describing her home city of Darwin in Australia to a man called Rob, who hopes to go there. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15 on page 67. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 15.
Joanne?
Hi, you must be Rob. Nice to meet you. So I hear you're planning to visit Australia.
Yeah, and I really wanted to talk to you because I was thinking of spending some time in Darwin and my sister told me you're from there.
That's right.
So tell me about it.
Well, where shall I start? Well, Darwin's in what they call the top end because it's right up at the northern end of Australia and it's quite different from the rest of Australia in terms of cultural influences. In fact, it's nearer to Jakarta in Indonesia than it is to Sydney, so you get a very strong Asian influence there. That means we get lots of tourists. People from other parts of Australia are attracted by this sort of international cosmopolitan image. And as well as that, we've got the same laid-back atmosphere you get all over Australia, probably more so, if anything, because of the climate. But what a lot of the tourists don't realise until they get there is that the city's also got a very young population. The average age is just 29, and this makes the whole place very buzzy. Some people think that there might not be that much going on as far as art and music and dancing and so on are concerned because it's so remote. I mean, we don't really get things like theatre and opera in the same way as cities down in the south, like Sydney, for example, because of the transport expenses. But in fact, what happens is that we just do it ourselves. Lots of people play music, classical as well as pop, and there are things like Artists groups and writers groups and dance classes. Everyone does something. We don't just sit and watch other people.
You said it's very international?
Yeah, they say there's over 70 different nationalities in Darwin. For instance, there's been a Chinese population there for over 100 years. We've even got a Chinese temple. It was built way back in 1887, but when a very bad storm, a cyclone, in fact, hit Darwin in the 1970s, it was almost completely destroyed. The only parts of the temple that survived were part of the altars and the stone lions. But after the storm, they reconstructed it using modern materials. It's still used as a religious centre today, but it's open to tourists too, and it's definitely worth going to see it. Oh, and as far as getting around goes, you'll see places that advertise bicycles for hire, but I wouldn't recommend it. A lot of the year it's just so hot and humid. Some tourists think it'll be fine because there's not much in the way of hills and the traffic's quite light compared with some places. But believe me, you're better off with public transport. It's fine and not expensive. Or you can hire a car, but it's not really worth it.
What's the swimming like?
Well, there are some good beaches, but the trouble is that there's this nasty creature called the box jellyfish, and if it stings you, you're in bad trouble. So you have to be very careful most of the year, especially in the winter months. You can wear a lycra suit to cover your arms and legs, but I wouldn't like to risk it even so, personally. And there are the saltwater crocodiles too. I mean, I don't want to put you off. There are protected swimming areas netted off where you'll be safe from jellyfish and crocs. Or there are the public swimming pools. They're fine, of course.
You now have some time to look at questions 16 to 20 on page 68. Now listen and answer questions 16 to 20.
So which places would you specially recommend?
Well, one of the most popular attractions is called Aquascene. What happens is every day at high tide, hundreds of fish come in from the sea, all different sorts, including some really big deep sea fish. And some of them will even take food from your hand. It's right in the middle of town at the end of the Esplanade. It's not free. I think you have to pay about $5, but it's definitely something you have to experience. Then, of course, Darwin has a great range of food. Being such a cosmopolitan place, and if you don't have lots to spend, the best place to go is to Smith Street Mall, where they have stalls selling stuff to eat. There's all sorts of different things, including Southeast Asian dishes, which I really like. You'd think there'd be plenty of fresh fish in Darwin, as it's on the coast, but in fact, because of the climate, it mostly gets frozen straight away. But you can get fresh fish in the restaurants on Cullen Bay Marina. It's a nice place to go for a special meal, and they have some good shops in that area too. What else? Well, there's the Botanic Garden. It's over 100 years old and there's lots to see. An orchid farm, rainforest, a collection of palm trees, a wetlands area. You can easily spend an afternoon there. That's at Fanny Bay, a couple of kilometres out to the north. Then, if you've got any energy left in the evening, the place to go is Mitchell Street. That's where it all happens as far as clubs and music and things are concerned. You'll bump into lots of my friends there. Talking of friends, why don't I give you some email addresses? I'm sure they wouldn't mind.
That is the end of section two. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 3 on page 69.
You will hear a conversation between three students who are preparing a presentation. You have 30 seconds to look at question 21.
Hey, guys.
Oh, hey, Gail. You made it.
Yeah, sorry. I was stuck at the library paying late fees. Have you guys started going through the data yet?
Yeah, we've already collated it and we've started designing the graphs we're going to use in the presentation.
Oh, really? That's fast.
Well, anyway, here's what we've got so far.
Okay, so... Wow, 38% said they thought about quitting school in the first year. That's a huge number.
Yeah, and only 10% said they were happy at school from beginning to end. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought the majority would be happy here.
Well, just remember that about 30% of the school population are foreign students. And from the UK students, only 2% are actually from the area. So, I guess it makes sense that people would miss home.
Yeah, but to want to actually quit school...
Well, they didn't want to exactly, they just thought about it.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 22 to 25.
Okay, so how should we organise the presentation? What did you guys decide?
Well, Kevin and I were saying that we should start by explaining what the topic of our research was and how we decided to collect the data. So, I'll start by saying that our topic was how first-year students felt a month after beginning school and how their attitudes progressed and changed by the end of the academic year.
So then we were thinking that I should explain that the population we want to study was obviously first-year students, but because we need their complete experience from the beginning to the end of their first year, we'd have to actually poll students in their second and third year. And then we said that you should explain how we access the population.
So I'll say that we got the permission from the school to go to different classes from different departments and hand out the surveys in paper form, right?
Right, and that it took us about 3 weeks to complete this part of our research.
So then we need to describe the three different areas of focus of our survey. So Lindsay can do that. Say that the survey had three sections. The first one, asking just some general questions about the age, gender, nationality and field of study of each student. Then the second one, focused on how they felt in their first 6 months at school. And the third, how they felt in the summer after their first year was complete.
That sounds good.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 26 to 30.
Okay, so let me see the breakdown. Okay, so we've got an equal distribution of boys and girls. That's good.
Almost equal. 51% of the participants were boys, the rest were girls.
Right, and 70% of the participants were British, while the other 30% were...
10% were from America and Asia, 2% were from Africa, and 18% were European. We had a small number of Australians as well, 0.03%, so I guess Europeans were 17.97%, if you want to be precise.
Which we should. Anyway, and obviously the age was all 20 or 21, with a few 19-year-olds. Only about 5%. No, wait. 4%. Right?
No, it's 5%. Look.
Right. Okay. So Lindsay will describe the three sections, and then you, Kevin, you'll describe the demographic and geographical breakdown, and I...
You can start with the graph, and then we'll all explain the data together.
Right. So we'll put this graph up on the board and explain that most students experience some form of homesickness or mild depression in the beginning of their course.
But we need to point out that by the end of the year, it was only 5% that still felt like quitting school.
Yeah, but remember that we didn't actually have the opportunity to interview or poll any of the students who left school. So the information we have only relates to current students, and those numbers might be bigger in reality.
Yeah, I guess we need to mention that. But we did check the dropout rate for the last 2 years, and it was very low. So at the end of the day, the numbers can't be much bigger.
Yeah. Anyway, so after we explain the data and we show the three graphs with the background information and the responses for 6 months and 1 year, we should spend some time also talking about...
You will hear a lecture about English language. You have 30 seconds to look at questions 31 to 37.
Those of you who were here last week will remember that we talked about the journey of the English language from its early Indo-European origins through to Old English, Middle English, and then to Early and Late Modern English before it reached the form that it has today. Today, we will be continuing that theme by focusing on the future of the English language and all the places it might go from here. There are about 2.1 billion people around the world who can speak English. Out of these, only 400 million are native speakers, which means that 4 in 5 English speakers are non-natives. This is obviously quite an impressive number, considering that just 2 centuries ago, in 1801, there were only about 20 million speakers of English around the world, and languages like French and German were ahead of English in terms of how many people were using them. But what does it mean? What it means is that the future of the English language doesn't really depend on its native speakers, but on that massive number of non-native speakers learning it around the world. Has anyone heard the term pidgin before, or Creole? A pidgin is a simplified version of a language which acts as a bridge between two people who don't have a common language, allowing them to communicate with each other. While a Creole is a language that evolves from a pidgin, with the difference that it is fully formed with clear grammatical rules and vocabulary. There are currently dozens of pidgin and Creole languages based on English around the world. For example, Nigerian pidgin or Jamaican patois. These languages are also known as Englishes. What's interesting about these Englishes is how different they sound to, for lack of a better term, proper English. Take the word trousers, for instance. In Sheng, which is a Kenyan Creole language, they're called longi because they're long. But even versions of English that are recognized as official variations or dialects still differ greatly from each other. Americans and Jamaicans would call the back of a car where you store your luggage the trunk. Britons, Australians, Canadians, and other Commonwealth countries would call it the boot. A subway in the UK is a tunnel under a road that allows pedestrians to cross safely. In the US, it's an underground train. You might think of these differences as minute, But when you take into account the dozens of different versions of English out there, a very intriguing parallel arises with another language from the past, Latin. Latin, too, used to be a lingua franca. Nowadays, it's all but dead, spoken only by a few clerics and scholars. At some point in history, it splintered into various different languages, which became known as Romance languages. For example, Spanish, Italian, or French. There are some that theorize that the same thing might happen to English in the near or distant future, that all these Englishes we have today in different countries will continue to develop, so pidgins will turn into Creole languages, and Creole languages will turn into just languages, and English itself, as we know it today, will disappear, or become less and less important. It's an interesting theory, if nothing else.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 38 to 40.
It makes sense that as English grows in popularity, countries, especially those with a strong sense of identity and tradition, will develop their own versions of the language, marked by the idiosyncrasies of their culture. Just think of the contribution of dialects such as Jamaican or South African English. In the past 50 years alone, they've added about 25,000 words to the English language. Most of these related to a local context that wouldn't have existed in English before the spread of colonialism. In terms of numbers, just those are enough for a brand new language. There are some flaws to this theory too, however. While it's true that Latin and English have a lot of similarities in terms of how they developed or have developed throughout history, there is one big difference. We currently live in an era of globalization. Today, you can be in India and stream an American film or TV series in seconds. You can be in Nigeria and listen to British music. You can be in Brazil and read a novel from an Australian author. Just a few centuries ago, this was unthinkable. So what's the other way that English could go? According to some experts, there's the possibility that it could maintain its status as the world's global language, but with a few differences. Already today, most conversations in English occur between non-native speakers. While many of these might be fluent, the majority probably only have an intermediate understanding of the language, devoid of the nuances, colloquialisms, and complex collocations that native speakers employ in their interactions. This means that over time, English could turn into some sort of world speak, the official lingua franca for the entire world, but in a simplified form. Some scholars have even started trying to develop that version of English by selecting the most useful words in the English vocabulary for non-native speakers to learn. Robert McCrum has compiled a comprehensive list of 1,500 words, for example, a version of English that he calls Globish. And what about traditional native speaker English? It might continue to exist, but lose its popularity, as the previous theory suggests. There are many more theories about the future of the English language, of course. I've only focused on the two main ones because they clearly demonstrate our uncertainty when it comes to how this beautiful language will develop. English is in a unique, unprecedented position. No other language has achieved the same levels of popularity in human history, especially in terms of non-native speakers. So, as this is clearly uncharted territory, only time will be able to tell us what will happen.